start back, how did you
get
into the Tantrid at all? I mean, where did you, how did you get into this?
I'll pay cash. I guess my background was a very strong influence in Hebrew. I went to yeshivot, and in the army, I was drawn to synagogue life when I served in the armed forces during the Korean War.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York, and I had a strong affinity for things that were Jewish, and fortunately, I was able to sing too. So I, at one point along the line, I was considering, I was a speech teacher for a while, I considered law, and my final choice was to serve as a cantor.
How did you go into reform?
Simply, no, my background was Orthodox.
Yeah,
rigorous Orthodox. But a cousin of mine who was a rabbi in Newark, New Jersey, told me about the cantorial school in New York City, that they had some of the finest people in the country. And I went down there for an interview, and I spoke with, I think it was Eric Werner at the time, and he's also in your field, a leading ethnomusicologist. And I was accepted to the school. I was very much interested in the school. I also went to the other school, the JTS, but I don't think they had enough to interest me.
So you began to practice right off?
Yeah, well, I was singing in a choir from the age of 9 to 14, and that I was an alto.
The regular, the big choirs? I mean, just
yes,
the, choir?
The big choirs. The Nadler Choir, Oscar Julius, yes. And it was over there for about 5 years, 9 to age of 14, walking down the aisle at weddings and singing Vimale. So I come from a certain niche over there. And that, in combination with my yeshiva training, which was Eitz Chaim and Yisroel Chanon in Manhattan, so I had a very strong inclination to serve congregational life.
Now, so where did you begin to work then? Where did you start?
Well, at HUC, you mean?
No, when you began to practice as a cantor.
Oh, as a cantor. Well, I was 20, let's see, I just got out of the army, and I was 22 at the time, or 24. Yeah, I was 24 years old, and I enrolled at the School of Sacred Music, and I went 4 years. My Hebrew was pretty advanced, considering my background, and it was the musical part of it that was a tremendous challenge to me, because even though I sang in a choir, I never really had any formalized training other than a few courses at the Tennyson, the Third Street Music School and the Henry Street Music School.
So, where did you get your first job?
It was close to New Jersey. And I was in my first year at cantorial school. And it worked out very nicely for a year.
Yeah.
And then at the end of a year, I was... Would you like some milk?
Sure.
I like to put the milk in before the coffee. Then it, that lasted a year, and then I got my second position. At the end of the first year, by the way, they presented me with a suitcase. So I took the hint and I took off. The rabbi also left. It was a very tiny congregation, very wealthy. But they only had, I think, I don't know, what was it, 75 families in close to New Jersey. Today, I think Kravitz is the rabbi, and they have a beautiful building. But at that time, they used to meet in a place called Legion Hall.
Yeah.
That was my first congregation. It lasted for a year. My second congregation was in Queens, Temple Shalom, Union Turnpike. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And it was over there that I served as cantor and youth group director for, I think, about 2 years until it wore me down and almost out. And after a couple of years, they gave me a very substantial raise, and I wanted very much to be the principal over there. So I was essentially Cantor educator.
Oh, okay.
And in 1958, when I was graduated from HUC, that was, let's see, I started in Sholem in 1955. So 3 years later, I graduated from HUC-SSM as a Cantor educator. And it was in that year that I became the Cantor educator there. And I was there for a total of 6 years, from 55 to 61. And the last few years, I served in that capacity. So that meant that I was Cantor and principal and director of the youth group. And it was a very, very tough job.
Yeah.
Very, very tough. And at the end of 6 years, there was an opening in Teaneck, New Jersey as Cantor. So I served over there for 9 years, strictly as Cantor. And then they offered me a 5-year contract, but I went down for a holiday to Miami Beach, and I kind of liked the climate. And I was 40 years old, and I just got my master's degree from Columbia, and I felt that I could be anywhere, anytime.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the timing was just of such a nature, you know, that I decided to accept this position that was offered me.
Yep.
They offered me a 2-year contract, and the salary would have been $8,000 less. And I decided $8,000 less was okay. And I went to Miami Beach.
You were really tired of Jersey.
No, I wasn't tired of Jersey. I think... I think the fact that I got my master's degree from Columbia had a lot to do with it. Choral music.
Uh-huh.
My first BA was from Brooklyn College.
Yeah.
That was in speech.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I took 36 credits in speech. Then, of course, I got the degree in the BSM from Hebrew Union College. That was another 4 years. Then at Columbia, I was going from 51 to 69. It took me 18 years to get my master's degree over there. Because in the beginning I started off in speech, and then, you know, I switched to music, and I got it in choral music. And in 1970, after the winter of 69-70, and my holiday in Miami Beach, and a number of other factors, I decided to move. And I've been there. I'm married, and I have a child, and I finished 15 years. I'm starting my 16th year in Miami Beach.
Is it different down there? I mean, aside of the retired, do you have retired people, or do you have younger people in your current
age? We have a very good mixture right now. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was a large percentage of retirees in my congregation, but presently, I would say it's probably maybe 40% young people.
Does that cause the change in the kind of music you do, or the approach you take?
It's an excellent question. I would say not really. Not really. I've always been a believer in congregational singing. My motto, my credo, happens to be, and I don't mind telling it to you because I mentioned it again at the last staff meeting at Temple, that a satisfied congregant is our greatest treasure. And I have always felt that there should be a part of congregational singing, you know, in every service. Every service, whether it be Shabbos morning or Friday night or the High Holy Days, that, let's face it, the congregants should be included as a consideration in everything that you do.
So that doesn't change, you mean? The older people were interested in that? Didn't they want to hear more...
traditional, you mean?
Yeah, sure. I
tell you, I try to combine all the elements.
Yeah.
All the elements. So in any service... you'll find 18th. Rossi would be much earlier. He would be 17th century, early 17th century. For example, there's Rossi that I do in every service, one selection, the Bayomahu, and a lot of 19th century, a lot of 20th. I guess most of the music that I do is anchored in the 20th century. I would say so. I would say so. I had the great pleasure of studying with Binder and Fried, and I corresponded with Heinrich Schalit until his death. When was it? 10 years ago. From 1958 till the time he died, I was in correspondence with him. What? Yeah, about his music. He sent me all his music. And the last few years, you know, when he was almost blind, you could tell that his music was less legible. But I've been doing Binder's music, whom I studied with, Fried's music. Eric Werner was one of the greatest teachers I've ever had, but unfortunately he was never a choir director, and this shows in the music that he composed, because if I wanted to lose a choir, I would use his music. Reuven Kosakoff, I almost lost his choir with one of the cantatas, with one of his cantatas that I did sometime in the 60s, A Song of the Wise. He was an organist and a wonderful organist, but he didn't have a great sense of the Marg line when it came to SATB. Excuse me, when I talk music, do you play the piano?
Yeah,
are we talking about this? Do I make myself understood when I talk to you this way? Yeah.
Do you think that still is the backbone of Reformed music?
What?
That generation?
No. I feel that the true, the cantor that is true to tradition will dip into every period.
Yeah.
For example, last year I did an all Lewandowski service, and it was absolutely inspiring to me to look at the music and to work with the choir on the music. This year we did the same thing with Isidor Fried. 3 years ago we did with Binder, and with others in the past. And I feel that the true cantor in congregational life will seek out the best from all eras. Michael Isaacson is good, but some of his music is way out, and he seems to be writing for himself. And some of his music is great with kids. His Via Haftar, a number of other selections, his Shalom Aleichem, my adult choir enjoy doing that. I think his Nishmat Chaim on the first presentation doesn't quite hit you. And I think Jewish music, Jewish musical composition, has got to hit you the first time. Martin Kalmanoff, for example, comes across much, much better, much more effectively the first time. Ben Steinberg is wonderful.
Now, when you say that it has come across the first time, you're thinking again from the point of view of the satisfied congregants? I mean, that they have to be able to hear it and say, we want to hear this again, or we understood it? Is that what you mean?
Look, you take Ernest Bloch. Ernest Bloch is a great experience for the cantor. And with the proper facilities, I think it could serve as an inspiration for the congregation. It's funny, I'm thinking of something that A.W. Binder once said. He said that the first time that he heard the Bloch Sacred Service, he was absolutely frightened by it, because he just couldn't understand it. Now, it happens to be a great vehicle for the cantor, and I think it's a unique service for the congregation. It's just fabulous. I've heard it, I don't know how many times, and it's still a fabulous experience. It's a unique experience. Some of the other great works, I think Millau is marvelous, but His music doesn't come across. His Lachado D is cute and whimsical, but his music doesn't come across to the congregation as a worship experience.
Now, so, I mean, again, that's the point, that you feel that it ought to come across and be accessible to them right away.
Unless you consider the whole thing to be a concert piece. For example, most of the Bloch service is a concert piece. Most of Mio is concert piece. Al Ghazi, on the other hand, I feel was a masterful composer, and his service, which came out, I think, in the 60s, I'm not sure of the exact date, early 60s, was truly, truly elegant, just beautiful and masterful. The works coming out today, I like Kalmanoff very much. I'm going to introduce some of his compositions this year. Michael Isaacson, I have,
so you have
reservations. Ben Steinberg is wonderful. Charles Davidson from the 60s and 70s. We're using some of his selections. In fact, I've proposed an all Davidson service later this year, just like we had an all Bonya Shore service. Bonya Shore has been to our temple a few times. I asked him to come last December when he was in town.
Do you like his approach? Because I've talked to people who don't like it at all.
Well, I happen to, he's been to my home for dinner on several occasions, and we know each other very, very well. Loves my wife. He conducted a choir rehearsal at my place last December, and I threw a cocktail party for him at my home a few days later. I invited 80 people. The year before, we did all his music in a service, and he gave the sermon. I could criticize Bonya Shore very easily, but I think he's a very creative force, and and I've enjoyed him tremendously, and he was a tremendously unique experience to my choir. They never had such a crazy time and such an inspiring time. And I told them afterwards that when I saw him conduct an open choir rehearsal, it was open to the congregation, and there were 40 people in my adult choir. It was just a unique experience for them. And I prepared 9 of his selections for that occasion. I prepared the choir with 9 of his selections. And he was just amazing, absolutely amazing. And I thought of some of the sessions, the musical sessions that I observed at, I forget the name of the school, was it the Rhodes School in New York City, where they have this very progressive teaching? No, it wasn't the Rhodes, was it the Rhodes? A very progressive school in New York City. It reminded me, it was very, very progressive education, using some of the progressive techniques. He was absolutely remarkable, remarkable. I wrote Norman Summers a letter about that, and I told him how refreshing he was and how inspiring he was to the choir.
Now,
I could criticize some of his music, you know, etc., but I don't think this is the opportunity.
No,
this is the time, rather.
Get down to the question of the service itself. What you feel is really your role, your functioning. What is the part of the what's going on when you are working with
a cantor works in two areas: religious services and religious education. And everything I do touches either on one of them or two of them. Everything I do.
Do you think of a service as educational? Are you teaching them the text?
One of the last recommendations I made to the rabbi a few months ago was that he should take a prayer every Friday night and highlight it and talk about it and comment on it. During the service, I would say it's primarily a religious service from the standpoint of the cantor. I mean, he chants the liturgy. He doesn't talk during the service.
Right, but is, I mean, in terms of commentary, that's a kind of commentary also.
Well, Wednesday night is the choir rehearsal, and the choir rehearsal combines both. It affords the cantor a marvelous opportunity to explain the liturgy and to talk about the background, the origin, and mix it with his own personal experiences, and you get something that is uniquely a cantorial contribution in terms of working with choirs.
Uh-huh. So you educate the choir.
There's no doubt about it.
Do you think that carries across to the congregation? I mean, how does the congregation get the sense that you have of the music text relationship? You know, so what gets conveyed to them? How does it work?
Well, there are many ways to reach a congregation. One way is through the bulletin, by articles. Another way is Friday nights, Shabbos morning services, and holy days. Another way is through the avenue of adult education, offering workshops, which I do. I teach in the adult education. Another way is through the children's choir, which I train. Another way is through the adult choir, which I train.
So there's a composite impact, a cumulative impact of your presence that way.
It takes a while. The first year that you do anything, for example, the first year that I came to Temple Sinai, which was 15 years ago, even though I had my own ideas had taken shape, nonetheless, I utilized some of the musical traditions that the congregation had at that time. I mean, you just don't start, you know, and erase everything in the past. You know, you come in with one third new and one third old, and the other third might be a combination. You know.
So you slowly educate them to your kind of sensibility, your kind of approach.
In the beginning, a congregation, some congregations will accept anything,
yeah.
Depending on what they had before.
Yeah.
Some congregations would accept, but with reservations.
Yeah.
In any event, the first 2 years is certainly a trial period. But after a couple of years, when they see that you're innovative, when you work hard, when you believe in what you do,
yeah.
And you're enthusiastic about your goals, then I think they're more relaxed and more apt to accept what you're trying to do. But it takes a while.
Yeah.
It does take a while.
So that then you think that you can create the right sort of prayer atmosphere?
That's something that constantly changes. Mm-hmm. That's something that is constantly changing. The cantor that I was, I'm finishing my 27th year,
yeah.
After graduation, and I have changed so tremendously over the years.
How so?
That's a tough question to answer. I know that I've changed. I think much more of the congregation today than ever before. I try to avoid selections that will only please me. Because after all, what is the role of the cantor? Well, his role cannot be sharply defined, as you'll find out. But one of the many things that you try to do is to elevate the intensity of the worshiper, to bring a little something into him that didn't exist before. One of my teachers once said, if you could influence one congregant a little bit with one selection, then you've done quite a bit. You know, his goal was very, very simple.
Yeah.
To try to please, you know,
yeah.
To try to do something, not to please,
yeah.
But to try to do something. I think he spoke in terms of elevating the
yeah.
intensity,
yeah.
You know, the intent of the congregant.
Yeah.
I think in my thinking today, I try to think of the congregant in whatever I do. At the same time, it has to be pleasing to me.
Yeah.
And therefore, Michael Isaacson, some of his music would be pleasing to me,
right.
But it's just too far out,
yeah.
Michutz la machane, outside the camp.
Mm-hmm. put any stock in the old term Shliach Tzibur? Or if you do, what does it mean here?
Well, I never used to do the Hineni prayer until I came to Miami Beach. I've worked with basically with three rabbis, 6 years, 9 years, and now with 15 years. The first rabbi was very, very classical. The second rabbi was tremendously orthodox background, but wanted to be as reform as possible in his approach. So let's see, my first congregation, I didn't wear a yarmulke, but wore a tallis. In my second congregation, I wore a yarmulke, but not a tallis. In my presently, I'm wearing both a yarmulke and a tallis. And presently, my rabbi comes from a very reform background, and he is trying to be a traditionalist. I come from a very strongly orthodox background, and I'm not interested in being reform or orthodox or conservative. I'm just trying to be the best cantor I know how.
Yeah.
And being the best cantor I know how, to me, means saying there is good in every part of our musical heritage. Let's try to take the best from every era.
Yeah. Shliach
Tzibur means messenger of the congregation, and
it does.
When I chant the Hineni,
yeah,
the Hineni is a prayer that really gets to me every year. It really gets to me, and I think it really brings you back to your roots. To your roots as a chazan, to your roots as a Jew, to your roots as a messenger of the congregation. And as a messenger of the congregation, you're praying for the congregation, you're doing many things as a messenger.
Yeah.
As a messenger, you're also trying to transmit the musical heritage.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I still feel that compulsion. To transmit the musical heritage, and there are many ways to do it. Through the kids, through the adult choir, through the articles that you write, through the adult education courses that you teach, through the people that you talk to in the congregation. And Friday night, I'm generally the last person to leave the shul. My wife does.
You don't get worked out.
Well, I'll tell you, that subject came up this morning. And we were talking about one particular individual.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a subject that I know very little of. I know that at times I feel that my battery needs charging and recharging. There's no question about it. And I know that this week it's going to be heavily recharged. There are times that it's good to get away.
You can't even go to Miami for a vacation.
That's true. But I'll tell you, one of the things that gives me such fiendish, outlandish, great, unique pleasure is to pick up music books and research new melodies, you know, for Hanukkah, for the children's choir, the adult choir. For example, this week I'm gonna go to the musical store on Ben Yehuda Street, and I'm gonna have a lot of fun buying music and bringing it back to me. And during the month of August, I'm gonna spend hours researching music, just looking at it. My wife very often comes up to me and says, "It's midnight. What are you doing down there?" And there is something so fascinating about, you must have heard the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
I was the first that ever burst into that adventurous sea. That's the way I feel when I'm looking at new music. It's a marvelous feeling, new publications, new books. One of the reasons why Bonya Shore called me up the first time was that of all the cantors in Florida, I was spending the most music on, the most money on his music. He said, why? I said, well, number one, I have a large adult choir, and I have to buy a lot of music. You know, I'm not going to buy two pieces and photostat it. You know, I'm going to buy, do it the right way. And I was spending quite a bit of music, quite a bit of money on music. And he wanted to ask me a number of questions. That was how I got to know Bon Yashour. This goes back about, 9 years ago, 10 years ago. Stop it for a moment.
Well, let's talk about the field in general. The introduction of women, the future of the cantor, and other such topics.
I think women are great. In the beginning, I guess some of us were probably uncomfortable with it. Because it was something new, it was something we weren't used to. But I have tremendous respect for female cantors that have been trained and have the proper credentials. I don't have respect for men that are improperly trained, and I don't have respect for women that are improperly trained. The only problem with women is that I hope that they will be accepted as quickly as men have been, you know, all these years. I remember there was a cantor from Jerusalem that was standing with me inside my ark, inside the ark of my synagogue. And he looked at me and he said, Irving, I will never, never, he said, b'chayai, in my life, will I ever be able to accept women in the cantorate? I said, look, you know, you have to move with the times, otherwise you're going to be swallowed up by it. And he just disagreed with me, I would say, vehemently. However, I accept them fully. And we're talking about females, women that have full credentials, and they are doing, I know the girls in the greater Miami area are doing a marvelous job. You know,
what
Rochelle Nelson.
Point where it's a woman's profession, which people are saying is going to happen. I mean, there are no men coming into it at all.
Well, you have to consider, I think for the next 20 years, I don't think the women will outnumber the men, any way you look at it.
Well, I'm talking about generations. I mean, if there are no men coming into it, you're going to have an age. You're going to have younger women and older men, or something.
Well, for the remainder of this century, you're going to have an overwhelming majority of male cantors.
Yeah.
And one more. For the remainder of this century, I can't see any serious problems developing. The overwhelming majority in the profession will be male cantors. So if you're talking about the year 2020, I don't know about that. But the next 15 years, I don't see any real problems. If anything, I think with the advent of more women into the cantorate, I think you're going to see a general improvement, which at the present time, I don't think you have. I think women are probably paid less and possibly exploited, more. I don't know, if women will bear me out, but I think that's generally true. I think in the next few years, as women enter, the profession more and more, I think the salaries will probably be equal.
Also, that women are paid well now, but watch out, it's going to decline. sketching out, and so forth and so on?
Well, I'm in Florida, and one of my one of the soloists in my choir, she has an outstanding voice, and she was engaged as a soloist in a temple, let's say 50 miles away, and she was paid far, far less. She was not a cantor, she was without credentials, she had an outstanding voice, and she was an excellent musician. She was paid far less. There was another soloist, the same thing was applicable. There were two females that came to the area, and they were properly credentialed as cantors. They were started with a minimum salary. So, you know, I'm talking about the greater Miami area. I know a little about that. Nationally, I really don't know all the facts nationally. You're in a better position than I to find that out.
I get really contradictory answers about the so-called facts.
Well,
I
you can.
People tell me, they'll tell you the facts are like this, but I.
Well, you can check that out very easily.
It must be
there's one very effective way that you can do it. You can go up to the pension chairman, who is Norman Summers, and say, look, there are how many full-time female credentialed cantors, and he'll give you a number, and he'll say, and you'll ask, in accordance with the pension plan, et cetera, how much are these girls making, females making, and how many years are they in the field? And I think that would would tell you the story. Yes, there's no question about that.
But the sensibilities are interesting.
I think they're gaining wider acceptance.
One woman cantor told me, look, I can't afford to have a child because they'll see me as, I'll have to take a little time off the job occasionally. They'll see me as a more part-time person. My salary will go down. They'll see me as a woman who's a wife and mother, and not as they won't hold me in the same respect. I mean, it's a serious question. That's curious.
However, a couple of years ago, some of the women were talking about provisions in their contracts that call for maternity leave, and I would suggest that in the next few years it'll be a standard provision in every female contract, which I think it should be, absolutely, because most of the girls in the field, they come to the field, let's say in their late 20s, 30s, and they're of childbearing age, and I see every reason why it should be. Well, that's a too general a question for me.
There's nothing that strikes you as being really important to go after at this point in the research?
You'd have to be very specific. I don't know where you're leading to.
No, I'm not. No. I'm just asking you from off the top of your head what you would tell somebody to look at.
Too many forks in that question.
Would you urge or recommend people to go into this profession?
I have urged a few people to go into the profession. These people had an inclination for it, for religious services, religious education. I mean, these two things are very important. And an affinity for, you know, synagogue life. And a good personality. I think personality is very important because it's very, very hard to succeed in this profession. It's very hard, just like in the rabbinate. It's very difficult to succeed. There are many rabbis that don't make it. There are many cantors that don't make it. It's a tough profession. It's a demanding one. And it's not a high-paying one. And it's one essentially of service. And I don't recommend it to everybody. But where there's an inclination, then I would recommend it. And I've recommended it to several people.
I was very surprised to hear somebody more or less your generation just come up to me today and said, you know, I was talking about this yesterday with six people over dinner, and we all agreed we wouldn't recommend anybody go into this field.
Well, I think that's their opportunity for sounding off. You know, it's a tough profession. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. You have to you can't be too sensitive if you're in public life, and your life is almost an open book, and the pay is. While it's good, it certainly is not great. You'll never be rich working as a cantor, but you'll have certain kinds of satisfaction, and it's demanding. It's a very demanding profession.